welcome to another Commercial Real Estate Professional Investors Group podcast with your host, J.W. Najeri, a Meta Media Group production.
This is J.W. Najeri, and I'm here today with John Nelson. How you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Good to hear you.
Good to talk to you. John is from CalCap Partners, and it's a venture capital company in Southern California. And I just want to thank you, John, for coming on today to talk to us a little about venture capital. A lot of people have questions about what venture capital is, and what you guys do, and how they can become involved, and all those kind of great things. So I really appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you.
So, for people who don't know John Nelson, many will not because CalCap Partners, you guys pretty much go by referrals only, isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, in fact, on your site, I don't think you have phone numbers or contact info even.
On purpose.
So John is former managing partner for multiple venture funds, including Gatekeeper International Funds, Ventana Technology, Gateway Fund, and Ventura Management Group. He's also a venture partner with Shepherd Ventures and Bengal Capital. Previously, John was the North American Investment Director for the Ministry of Treasury of Australia and the CEO of several successful turnarounds. John's areas of focus include IT, computer science, economics, life sciences, and Asia Pacific Rim. You have multiple degrees. You've studied your PhD, your MBA in economics. You have a formidable resume, as it were.
Well, thank you. My parents would say I wasted too much time in school.
Well, it makes you a perfect candidate to talk to us about venture capital today. So let me start out with my first question. Venture capital, what's the difference between venture capital and hedge fund?
Well, to begin with, venture capital is kind of a term that's used ubiquitously for anybody who invests in the lay public, but kind of in the industry, we mean it's you're managing other people's money. OPM as opposed to being an angel investor, which is a form, I guess, of venture capital, but you make decisions on your own account. You're not a fiduciary. And that type of venture capital, managing a fund of other people's money, is generally considered somewhat patient money in that the partnerships for investment are about 10 years long. Now, contrast that to a hedge fund, which is really looking for an arbitrage, you know, buy low, sell high. And the turnover in those types of deals is very short as opposed to venture capital. However, I will comment, I might be getting ahead of you, JW, a little bit, but the venture capital model, many argue it's a little broken because those 10-year partnerships don't appear long enough anymore to get the harvest of investments back. About a year ago, the North American Venture Capital Association indicated that the average hold is now over 9 years on a deal, and that doesn't really work in a 10-year partnership. So the biggest difference, I think, between hedge and institutional venture capital is the amount of time in the hold and probably the degree of involvement with the investing, the company you invest in.
Venture capital, are they much more integrated into the deal?
Yeah, I think the majority of venture capitalists would say they're value added, which means they meddle with your company. And that can be a good thing if their meddling is positive. It could be a bad thing if you don't like them. So
right. The
important thing is make sure you get married to somebody you like.
And what would be some of the key points to look at when you're...
Well, I think one of the things that's real important that's often underlooked is an entrepreneur should do due diligence on the investor just like the investor does due diligence on the entrepreneur. And that is, many venture capitalists, in fact most, except us, publish on their websites their portfolio companies with web links. If I were an entrepreneur, and I suggest this to entrepreneurs every day, I would go to those sites before they meet with a VC and talk, try to find companies that look or are in a similar industry to what I'm in, and call their CEO and say, listen, I'm having a meeting with these people who backed you. I'd like to talk to you a little about, you know, let's meet at Starbucks. I'll buy you a cup of coffee and about your experience. And if you think that, you know, would there be someone you'd recommend getting involved? Would you do it again with these people? That's very easy to do. It's amazing how few people do that.
Okay. So, John, what kind of, what is the, you know, I hate to say the perfect client, but what does a typical venture capital client look like?
Well, I think there's somebody who is a type A, that's driven and won't accept no, for an answer. Very often there's somebody who've weathered some type of adversity in their life and been able to overcome it. It could have been a family, it could have been financial. We expect people who, to have people who also are, this is a term often used by VCs, who are coachable. You know, there's nobody who has all the answers. We don't have all the answers, and it's a team approach. So having receptivity to having the right people get involved with your company at the right time is an important characteristic of the successful entrepreneurial team.
Okay, and so venture capitalists, are you guys looking for new companies? Are you looking for established companies that need your help?
Well, it changes because there are venture capital funds that are called seed funds that get involved with, you know, basically a kind of a concept penciled out on a napkin, is the old cliche.
Right.
But with the economy, and that has gone away. Unless you're a known entity that the VC, your VC has backed you before and they really think you're brilliant and whatever you do, you know, it's going to be great. That's about the only people who can get that kind of money. More and more, because the economy, VCs have been looking longer term and later in the stage, so that there is already a product developed.
Right.
It's proven that the dogs will eat the dog food. In other words, their sales.
Right.
And it gets more and more attractive the more revenue there is, and if the company is either achieved EBITDA or it's there right on the horizon. Of course, when you get to that stage, the competition amongst VCs to invest in a deal like that becomes more keen.
Okay. And venture cap, you know, you say you get much more involved in the company. I was going over some of the things that you do for the client, and it's a very long list of things that you can get involved with, whether it be helping them get capital, working with IPO, just all kinds of stuff. What kind of stuff do you help the client with?
Okay, well, I'd like to give you kind of a two-pronged answer on that. One is, I think VCs generically will try to bring resources to the table in terms of recruiting resources. As you grow and you have holes on your management team, they will help you because they have networks and close ties to executive recruiters in your industry to find the best talent at a reasonable price. Same thing for audits, auditors and accountants and IP kinds of services that professional services provide. So that becomes somewhat generic. Now, specific to CalCap Partner, we do some things I think that are a little more atypical, but because we have three principals, or managing directors in our firm and 20 venture partners, which is almost turns the traditional model on its head. I'd say if there's an average out there, the average fund would have 4 to 6 partners and maybe 1 or 2 venture partners. The reason we've done it this way is our venture partners primarily are ex-C-suite executives with industry expertise or very specific domain knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
and they act as either advisors or directors or sometimes board observers to the company and actually will take interim roles with the company. And the other aspect that's perhaps a little bit different with us is that as opposed to just being pure venture capital, we're a merchant banking platform. So we say that our venture capital side is our principal investing activity. We have another activity, which is investment banking and broker-dealer operations, which is agent activity, and a third, which is management consulting. That gives us a full spectrum through the life cycle of an investment. And so we have very strong resources in-house to take a company out and to sell it in an M&A environment, or to list it on a variety of exchanges, if not in the U.S., perhaps overseas in Germany or the TSX in Canada. And that's our strength, is we have very good liquidity records.
Right. And so you also have investors that invest with you to make money off these the companies that you turn around. Is that correct?
Yes, we do. And I think a number of funds do. Historically, the funds that I've been involved with have fewer, say, pension funds, which tend not to direct invest, and more strategic investors like multinational corporations or private pension funds and family offices who sort of have as their mission to try to get more of a good thing. So the fund typically will take first rounds of investments by itself, and then our investors, we give them an opportunity in subsequent rounds of investments when our deal is going well, we give them a first right to co-invest with us, carve part of the investment out. If they say yes, they can double down. If they don't have to, the fund will continue to go on its own. But that allows those people who want to throw their hat in the game and perhaps increase their position to do that.
Right. Okay. So would you say that the venture capital or managed fund is a higher risk reward investment?
Yeah, I guess I would say it. Of course it's shown to be somewhat high risk in the last decade because
right.
many funds have not done well.
In fact, you were saying, I think you said to me earlier when we were speaking that venture capital firms are about 50% of them have gone away in the last few years.
The statistics that are out there reading the industry papers and periodicals more or less say there'll be about a 50% contraction in the number of managers managing funds between 2008 and the close of next year, 2012. Anecdotally, it looks about that way. It's turning out that way to me. That doesn't necessarily mean a 50% shrinkage in dollars,
mm-hmm.
because the big funds
are still out there.
Yeah, the big ones are still out there, still managing money. They may not be getting great returns, but it's like the old axiom from back in the 60s and 70s, no one ever got fired for buying IBM. So a big name branded tier one fund is always going to get big dollars.
And these managed funds, some of the issues with them, M&A issues, IPO issues,
I think the biggest issues is right now they don't have very good opportunities for exit or liquidity of their investments. The M&A market still is pretty robust, but of course the multiples you can get from selling to a private large company who are cashed up quite well aren't the same as they were 4 or 5 years ago in large. I mean, there's always exceptions, but by and large, if you're willing to accept a smaller multiple, but, you know, some fund managers are, you know, they think, oh, good times are just around the corner. Let's hold out for an extra, you know, 1 or 2x multiple on top of what they're offering now. And that's becoming somewhat problematic. And, I know personally, I'm probably the most aggressive on my team is, you know, I'd sell it 2 times my money every 2 years. And that's a very strong IRR to my investors. But, you know, liquidity is the name of the game. But as I alluded to earlier, the venture model has gotten to where the hold is so long that the amount of return you have to get when you hold an investment for 9 years to get a good IRR is huge.
Yeah. So is this based on, we used to have an appreciating economy and all the rules apply and work, but in this depreciating economy, you kind of have to change the rules a little bit or how you approach the paradigm. Is that correct?
Radically. Yeah, you have to change it a lot. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, maybe we're hyping ourselves a bit, but we always say, you know, some of the greatest opportunity lies in adversity. Mm-hmm. So in our space, we have less competition than we ever had before. And we always have put a tremendous amount of emphasis before we put dime one into a deal in understanding how we're going to get out of the deal. And usually we have a pretty good idea who the buyers are. And we actually start talking to the buyers before we invest.
Right.
So to that extent, we're talking them through the whole life cycle of the investment.
Mm-hmm. And this is where liquidity becomes very important?
Yes. You know, and in fact, there's a lot of, comparability between a fund manager and the entrepreneurs they finance, because each of us have to go out and look for money. You know, we're managing other people's money, so we have to raise money. And then we have a fiduciary responsibility to optimize the return to our investors. And that has to do with liquidity. And if there's no liquidity event, you know, I suppose investors like to do good, but they indeed have a responsibility to their shareholders to do well.
Right. So, I know that you worked in Asia. I want to get to the Pacific Rim. Some of this, because I know you've lived there and worked there a long time. But I also wanted to talk about. I hate when I forget what I was. I hate when I edit here. what was the question I wanted to ask? Maybe I'll remember it because I can't remember it now. So John, you've worked a lot in Asia. You've in the Pacific Rim. Are you working with companies out there now?
Yes, we're still working with companies. We're also working with helping companies go to Asia, companies that are here for their markets. In some markets, China's become a more dynamic market than the West.
Right. But we hear a lot of stories about Asia, you know, like it was growing strong, but now they're having some housing issues and some other issues. Are these truisms? Are they correct? Are there problems out there? Is there a bubble happening? What's going on in Asia?
Well, I don't believe it's quite the bubble bursting economy problem like we had in 1997, 1998, but indeed the economic milieu we're feeling in the West, and you know, I keep hearing the last couple months is, well, we're in trouble here, but hey, we're better off than Europe. Well, Asia is included in that as well. You know, they're largely affected by how things are going in the rest of the world. You know, they're trading to us. They want to make sure we have enough money to buy their stuff. And so there are effects. One of the big differences, however, I think, with the ascendancy of both China and India is they have very sizable domestic markets which are not sated in terms of demand for things. And that could be B2C, business to consumer, or even B2B. So while there might be housing issues and other types of things that sort of develop out of maybe sort of socio-political economy, it's very difficult to turn the faucet off when you've started the ascendancy of a middle class with disposable income. And one of the things that is very notable, that I just actually read something on this weekend, is the degree of savings in those middle classes is so much higher than the West.
Right.
Of course, U.S. is at the bottom of the scale. The Europeans save more than we do. But in China and India, in the middle class, the savings are maybe four times what the Europeans do. So
right.
That gives them a bit of resiliency in a wavering economy to still go out and buy things.
Right. And I didn't mean to be so vague as to say Asia Pacific Rim, because there's a lot of different things happening with the different countries, whether we're speaking about Japan, Korea, Vietnam, Taiwan, China, or even India.
Yeah.
There's differences between those countries. Are you working mainly in China?
I'd say we have increased our focus and input in China considerably. Where I'd say in the Asia funds I ran in the 90s, China was kind of everything else but China. But now China's definitely in our center focal position. There's one other aspect in investment that I'm seeing arise, and I haven't met the funds in the United States that do this, but both in Korea and Taiwan, for example, there's a lot of technology being developed in research institutes and universities that is being sold directly to venture capitalists. And the venture capitalists are buying that technology and then basically hiring or causing a company to be formed around it. They're bringing in the entrepreneurs. It's quite a bit different model than in the U.S., where we're expecting the entrepreneur to go find the technology or develop the technology, commercialize it, and then we'll finance that climb. And in an article that I read recently, it mentioned that there are two firms in the Bay Area that have taken this up, and that VCs are missing a huge opportunity not to to jump on that bandwagon. So it's kind of interesting how that's going to develop. We've been looking at that. In fact, we have a couple deals ourselves outside of the U.S. where we basically have taken an option on technology and have brought in the entrepreneurs to take it to the next level.
Well, that kind of segues into the next question, and that is the sectors that are good investments. I know that you kind of focus on technology. Is that one of the emerging good sectors? Has it been a good sector? Is it slowing down, or are there other sectors that we should be looking at also?
Well, I guess part of it is, you know, what you're comfortable with. So my partners and I have been in technology most our whole lives, and technology is revolutionary. It touches almost everything. A lot of people, the lay public, doesn't realize when they buy their white goods, their washer, dryers, dishwashers, you know, there's basically chipsets and circuit boards in there now, which are tech-based. So it's reached way down into the consumer market. That being said, there are aspects of technology markets that are more difficult. For example, in our firm, it'd be very difficult to get through a committee investment in enterprise software. We're looking more at the applications market, very specific applications. Wireless technology is still a hot area, particularly wireless married to something else like medical.
Mm-hmm.
Health tech in our own portfolio currently dominates, and but also goes all the way down to an area we call lifestyle therapeutics, which is sort of science-based but non-FDA-approved things and therapies, which is a huge market with the aging of the developed nations.
Right.
People wanting to have either live longer or live longer with a higher quality of living.
Right. And you were mentioning to me before something, one of the sectors out there that's doing really well are pharmaceuticals. And we got into the conversation about, well, you know, China's kind of has a bad, you know, name for putting out some, you know, not so good, not so quality nutraceuticals, which leads into another conversation about the fact that something you mentioned earlier, and that is they have a lot of money and they're looking for quality goods and wanting to spend premium prices for things from the West.
Yeah,
I know that's not, that's kind of six questions in one, but.
Right. Well, let me qualify that to the extent. I think I was talking mainly about nutraceuticals as opposed to ethical pharmaceuticals, because the cost of bringing ethical pharmaceuticals to market in the U.S. is just so astronomically high that for us as a venture fund, it doesn't work. On the other hand, this nutraceutical area, a lot of it is, in fact, snake oil and marketing and branding and all of that, but there are products out there that are science-based that have IP behind them, for which clinical trials are done. They're just not an FDA product because they're not changing the structure of the cell or the body.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, we have looked, and that's one of the reasons one of the companies I mentioned that we've started is in this space, in what's called the cosmeceutical space, with a very broad patent portfolio. And key market for this company's products is Asia, particularly China, because they're using organic products. They're not produced in China. And as we mentioned in a prior conversation, JW, the consumer there that has disposable income wants to have a product with purity, and they can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very large and robust market that's basically there's a hole in the market for those products.
And this is funny.
I learned this when I was overseas.
Things you're being taught about the fact that China's taking over the world in manufacturing, and the truth is that if we look at things like this, there are some major opportunities, are there not?
Yes, yes. And I've been on a number of flights. This, of course, is just anecdotal information. But, you know, when you're trapped in a seat next to somebody for 15 to 16, 17 hours, often strike up a conversation. Frequently, I'm with people who live in China or elsewhere in the region there who are just going back with potloads of stuff that they buy here, of organic vitamins, organic materials, and quality products that they have a hard time finding in China. They have to pay a real premium in China, where here they might be discounted even. And so they go on regular buying sprees over here. And so what we've done is, through some of those relationships that have developed, we've developed distribution channels to push our products through so they'd be more available in China so people don't have to take a flight over here to get them.
That's great. Also, I think we touched on before, and I know we're getting out of venture capital a little bit, but it's an interesting conversation. And that is another truism that we always hear is that, all the corporations are going overseas and we're losing all the jobs here. And the truth is, I mean, since World, I remember hearing in World War I where we, or two, where we brought over, German scientists and scientists from other nations to help us with our, rocket and missile programs. And, we've always been bringing in talent from overseas. Is that correct?
Always. I mean, I think there's some kind of ad on TV from, on one of the things from some news guy who's talking about immigration and how it's been part of the American experience. And, you know, I think if we go all the way back to the creation of our railroads and our communications and transportation systems, those were largely done by immigrant laborers, not high-tech brain labor. But given my age and eras, I'd say from the 60s through till recent, most of our high-tech revolution in Silicon Valley has been on the backs of a lot of immigrants. They might not be the face of the company, but if you look at any of the big IT computer companies and look in the C-suites and look at the development teams, you're going to see many ethnic Chinese and East Indians involved. And that has been, and many then have branched off on their own, become very significant entrepreneurs with big companies themselves in the U.S. One of my concerns, however, is that I think something, the balance has changed over the last decade. And while many people are still coming to the U.S. For their education, they're not staying anymore because they just haven't seen the opportunity.
You're talking about retaining this talent.
Yeah, and for example, I know.
It's not as easy as what used to be because, since we don't have the opportunity here, we used to.
Yes, I've spent a lot of time in India the past 20 years and have many friends there, in the educated classes. And a lot of their kids that have come up or are coming up now would view IIT as sort of their first choice, most difficult to get in, the highest value education. And they look at MIT as maybe, or Caltech as kind of a distant second. That's their backup plan. That has changed. It wasn't that way 10 years ago.
Wow, that's really interesting. So globalization is here to stay.
Our jewels in the crown are now being considered by some is like, well, okay, if I have to settle, I'll settle for MIT. Kind of funny.
Yeah, it's funny and it's sad.
Maybe just ironic.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to make this a political discussion about what we need to do or not do, but it's a very interesting point to bring up. Let's get back to what you do as a venture capitalist, in turning a company around. Oftentimes these companies have been mismanaged, they haven't done exactly what they needed to do, they're having issues. So your company will go in there, with money and with talent to turn these companies around. How does that work?
Alright, well so, the sort of preamble comment is, while it's not 100% true, in my experience I haven't really seen investment or business failures because of technology and markets. I looked over my own portfolio and I actually didn't really see any that met that criteria. Usually it's people problems and issues. So the thing is be able to identify and diagnose a people problem before it impacts the company too adversely. That's why you take an active role as a venture capitalist in your company. You monitor it closely. You also try to have the control exercise with the other board members, et cetera, that you can affect what changes have to be done. Now, on our own behalf, we've done a lot of venture debt activity, which gives us kinds of covenants that we wouldn't have in the venture equity world. So I'd say in the past, post-millennium, we've pulled the trigger on two companies where we basically foreclosed on the company because of performance covenant and recapped the company under new management. And so that's the type of activity we do. But I think if I were to be critical of us, WeVC, it's very often is we wait too long hoping for the best, or, you know, because you form a relationship with people, you are, you know, they're advocates, you invested in them, and to have to put them into an appropriate place, which might not be as leading the company, is a difficult thing for everybody. That's why I think also, it's important at the very onset to discuss and have an understanding with the entrepreneurs and management of what the life cycle of a company is likely to be, and that, you know, we tend to try to invest in people who don't think they have to be the CEO forever. Mm-hmm. They're the CEO until this, you know, the company hits this level or this problem, and then maybe they're the CTO or the chief science officer or chief marketing officer or what have you. Because a company goes through an evolution, and the same person, some people can't evolve quite the same as the company does.
Right. So is the main problem, some of it micromanagement, or some of it the failure for people or for managers and CEOs to want to change or to realize that they have to change? Is there a denial factor here?
I think the answer to that is yes. Sometimes it's micromanagement, sometimes it's macromanagement. It's really situational.
Right.
You know, we have some people who are real, particularly with a very technical or science-based management team. They're the people who created the product or service. They're so enthralled with their baby, you know, that they forget that they have to go out and sell the baby to be in business. And they keep wanting to improve because, you know, the half-life of technology development, is huge. I mean, what is it? The something like 94% of all technology that exists since the dawn of Homo sapiens has been developed in the last 50 or 60 years.
Right.
And probably 25 years from now, we'll say it's been developed in the last 30 years. So it's huge. And
we have other issues too. Tell me if I'm wrong. Companies like REM and large banks that have failed, that whole too big to fail thing is kind of a premise that doesn't follow anymore. Technology changes so quickly that MySpace is the huge guy today, but Facebook is the huge guy tomorrow. And you need to be able to turn the big ship on a dime sometimes.
That's right. And sometimes if the ship can't be turned, you have to settle for what you can get out of the ship today for salvage parts.
Right.
And that's a hard decision for investors to make. And what I was trying to allude to is that very often they take too long to make that decision.
Right.
So, and particularly when you're holding on to a deal for 9 years, time is risk and time is money. And so, you know, our kind of credo here is get in and get out as fast as possible. It's continue to be impatient.
And, yeah, even Warren Buffett had to change his mind about buy and hold, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a different environment we're working in now.
Okay, let's change a little, turn a little bit. I don't know how much we're turning here, but I wanted to speak. You talk a lot about volatility. Can you talk to that?
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about volatility kind of throughout the conversation. There's volatility within the industry. Obviously, there's a lot of change going on. We were in the process. The current fund we have is down to its reserves, and we were going to go out and raise money a couple years ago, and we got ourselves ready to do that. And we made the decision not to at this time because there are so many of those VCs that are kind of being thrown overboard, that in that retraction of the number of venture capitalists, that they're all scrambling out in the market wanting to stay in their comfort zone. They want to continue to be a venture capital manager. And there's a lot of noise in the market, the fundraising market. And we determined, well, looking at some people that we, you know, obviously there's some we know and don't like, but there's many we know and like, and we think have very credible records, and their inability to raise significant capital on fairly impressive records over the last 2-3 years, telling us, well, that's a waste of our time and money right now, so we're going to wait till things settle down, the market's less volatile. And also, it's not a buyer's market, per se, from the institutional capital that we manage. You know, if I wanted to have a job, you know, work for somebody, work for a pension fund, I'd go work for a pension fund. I don't want to be a venture capitalist working for a pension fund on the pay-to-work program. So there's volatility within the industry. And then we have the other volatility in the market in which we invest. And we need to take a hard look at, say, where are the winners? Where are the losers? What industries can survive an unstable milieu and are likely to come out the other side, as you said, in the changed environment in which we're living. And we're saying that, well, by and large, in the West, we have this huge underserved demand from the aging baby boomers. They are technology savvy, by and large. The people who will accept technological solutions and are interested in that. So that's an important market. We also probably have some of the best opportunities in the sort of clean and green world starting to develop and advanced materials that support that. And then, you know, in much of the developing part of the world, there's another big area of demand is we have this huge cadre of young people between, say, 18 and 30 who have advanced educational degrees, but because of their countries and their economies, are unemployed. So you have all these unemployed young men and women, and that's kind of I don't want to get into the political side of that, but that can create a lot of unrest when there's no employment. So there's a real opportunity to take a look and say, how can those people be deployed? And is that a labor market that can be tapped for our companies and give those people opportunities at a cost-effective basis? So volatility exists almost in every layer of the equation of the private equity investment world.
Well, let's talk about, not to get political, but let's talk about that a little bit. What do you feel from, you know, your expertise is maybe some of the answer or the answer to what needs to be done? Do the governments need to come in and, you know, and put money into education or technology or jobs? Or is the private sector going to be able to pull us out if they do the right things? And what would that be?
Well, I guess I put on my old economist hat. I'm not trying to take a side here, but
sure.
I haven't seen, you know, if you look back all the way to the panic of 1887, I mean, public spending always has been part of a solution to a systemic economic problem.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems with, I think, saying that the private sector alone can do it is the private sector has a responsibility to its shareholders, not everybody else.
Right.
And so it's much more narrow in its focus. So it's the balance between the two that has to take place. So perhaps enabling, and in the U.S., I know a lot of people on both sides of our sort of, you know, two-party system. Well, people keep thinking there needs to be more, but effectively there's two. Is infrastructure development, which could create a lot of employment, but also deploy a lot of technology. I mean, we've been taxing for roads and transportation for decades and decades, you know, since we built the coast-to-coast freeway system, but we haven't maintained it. I mean, I was shocked when the I-35 over the Mississippi River fell down a couple years ago. But now we have smart materials. So things can be retrofitted with materials that basically are somewhat corrosive tolerant or can tell you before they're going to fail. And that actually creates opportunities not just at the construction trades level, but at the technology level. But that has to be fostered. And my own personal view is that two of our biggest problems with our economic woes, and I'm, you know, taking on my patriot hat here because I live here, rather than just talk about the West in general, but is education and healthcare. And, you know, until we have an education system which is more attractive and works, I don't see how we can have a robust economy. We were living on the best and brightest of immigrants for many years, and as I alluded before, they're not coming, and those who are coming here still to get their advanced education aren't staying.
Right.
In some areas, you know, over 90% in science and engineering, over 90% in some schools of graduate students are foreign. And then they're going home because they don't see the opportunity here anymore. So what are we getting out of that? We're educating people, sending them home, and improving their economy. So until we solve our education problem and also control our costs and health, I don't think we're going to have the vibrant economic environment that we need to be.
Yeah, and that kind of leads into my next question. That's about regulation. Is regulation helping earning, or is that too vague a question to really ask? I'm sure there needs to be some regulation, but sometimes a lot of the regulation becomes extremely restrictive to growth.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I wish I had a cohesive and consistent point of view on that.
Right.
I mean, I'm just so disgusted with what I see happening now that regulation now is everything is so political and politicized and bipolar that, you know, our regulations are so overwrought, like the Sarbanes-Oxley solution and actually tightening and raising that bar even higher has made the cost of being public in the U.S. and the risk of going public so much higher than some of the foreign exchanges.
Right.
I was told by the head of litigation of a venerable, very well known and respected Canadian law firm that, you know, in one of their bourses there, they've had two lawsuits, shareholder lawsuits, in a decade. And he said to me, John, you realize that on the year three New York exchanges, there's more filings of lawsuits per hour than we've had in 10 years. Well, okay, that's kind of a consequence of regulation.
Right.
There has to be a streamlining. And it's not a matter of distrust the private sector, but it's got to put things in that make sense. If you're trying to punish a couple bad hedge fund managers, you don't come in and take out all of venture capital and private equity.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the things that have been come through I've seen the last few years are very strong disincentives to my industry from a regulatory perspective.
Is that mainly Sarbanes-Oxley, or are there others? Like
no, there's a bunch of the other bills now that are coming out, and they're
going to
start taxing us on realizations before we can realize.
Oh, right.
Taxing our carried interest.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, on the one hand, they're trying to stimulate more investment into small business, but they're making it less attractive to do it.
Yeah, so.
And a big part, I think, is we are, you know, and I know this is maybe too political, but we don't really have the sort of citizen government. People go in with a skill, serve a little bit of time, get their input and look. Instead, we've got career, congressmen and senators who have been so long out of a job in an industry, that you know, they take their, where do they get their information? Lobbyists. So, I mean, I have to think we don't really have a knowledge-based government in large part.
Yeah, the focus
decisions.
In government is not on making things better, it's on keeping the status quo, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
So,
you know, just, and we're competing.
I pulled you into political. I apologize about that, but you know, it kind of gives us a window into where we're going and how we're going to get there. And, it is, there's a lot to dismay over.
Yeah, well, it's hard not to touch into the political because it is part of the recipe. And we are competing with nations just across the border, say in Canada, or in Asia or in Europe, where governments has created R&D incentive programs and or streamlined their public markets or, you know, done other things that are very difficult for us to compete with now. For example, in Canada, we can buy an option on a very small amount of money on any life science company coming out of a university or research institute, and each province will, you know, say we put down $5,000, they'll give us 15 for a 6-month option to do evaluation. You know, a 3-to-1 look. You know, if we want to run with it, then we have to license it and buy it and all of that. But that's a nice incentive.
Right. So I think some of the answer would be about something we touched on earlier, and that is that, as a business community, we have to stop believing everything we have, you know, everything we continue to hear in the media about how jobs are moving and Europe and China are growing and we're tumbling, and we have to start looking at the opportunities and not the problems.
Yes.
If we focus on the opportunities, whatever we focus on will expand, hopefully.
Correct. And we also have the reach and the wealth right now to be able to look at any market in the world. But, you know, we need to pick and choose. And I think a lot of people, unfortunately, are kind of having to hunker down in a hole and wait until, things become more solid. Well, that's one survival strategy. But on the other hand, there's a lot of opportunities that are missed. And, you know, even if we go back to other difficult times, lot of family dynasties were created out of the Great Depression.
Right.
Wealth. A lot of product development. A lot of industry boost came out of that. Out of the wars.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the issues that I see, though, and you touched on it earlier, was there's a lot of capital out there. And it's not like a, well, a little bit. You know, if you go back and you look at 1929 when the market crashed, and you look at when the economy came back, it actually took till 1958 till the economy was actually moving again. If you look at the S&P at that time.
Yes.
And if you look at unemployment and what's going on in the country today, even though the markets are up and then the markets are down, and then we just find out that, you know, the housing market might be worse than we thought because the National Association of Realtors misreported some things, you know, and the commercial real estate market, which I work in, is having issues, and we actually believe that we might be flat or maybe, at best case, 3% growth over the next 10 years. There's not a big out. There's not a big win going on unless, and this is just my opinion, unless we get jobs going again.
Yeah, I think you're correct. And so how do we do that?
Yeah, that's one of the issues that, you know, it's the $64,000 question. You know, how do we get those jobs? And are the jobs that the government are putting out only going to be a lower class? They're not going to help the middle class.
Well, and again, what's been learned since the 80s, since the leadership in the early 80s, when we had the huge run-up of unemployment, and Reagan decided, well, what we're going to do is we're going to improve employment, not by creating jobs, but telling how we report unemployment.
Right.
So now, unemployment means only those people collecting unemployment benefits. Well, you know, in California, I talked to the chief economist for Wells Fargo last year. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I think the reported unemployment in California was like 12.7%.
Mm-hmm.
And he said from their actuarial tables, they track what they consider the real or the shadow unemployment. It was 23%.
Mm-hmm.
A huge difference. You know, generally, the real unemployment is about twice what the government reports. So this is another problem, is that, you know, we're trying to fool ourselves with these numbers. And both parties do that because, you know, they make themselves look good. But the issue is very difficult to come up with a good solution, dig yourself out of the hole, unless you have good information.
That's true. That's absolutely true. We give no answers here. We're just discussing the issues.
Right. And the bump in employment, coming back to your point, was it last week or the week before? Isn't it great? Our unemployment claims have dropped. Things are turning around. And then parenthetically, next few days, well, of course, that didn't include those people whose benefits have run out. And those people who aren't looking are in those industries that aren't reporting. Well, it turns out that I saw a statistical analysis of that, is the improvement was more than offset by those people they just said. So are things better? No. So what do we need in this case? I think government has a big responsibility of creating the incentives. But we can't even get an employment tax break.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, because people talk all the time about it, and, you know, being on the venture capital side of things, I think you touched on it a little bit, and that is that there's a lot of capital out in the markets, but because we're not in an appreciating economy, that capital is not necessarily moving. I know it's not in commercial real estate. There's a lot of people who want to do deals. There's a lot of funds, hedge funds, I know, that really want to buy deals and do deals, and there's a lot of retailers out there that want to buy stores and make more stores, but they're having a really hard time moving because of the same thing that you were talking about with venture capital, and that is you need an exit strategy, and with a depreciating economy, that's kind of hard to find sometimes.
Yes, that's the case. And I talked to two areas that we track fairly closely. One is family offices, which have been a source of capital for funds for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, kind of family dynasties that manage sometimes multi-billions of dollars. And they're sitting on a lot of cash. as well as some of the industries, ethical pharmaceuticals or medical device manufacturers. You know, their balance sheets are quite strong. They're sitting on a lot of cash. They'd like to go out and make some acquisitions because this is the time to buy, because they'll get the best multiples on buying new technology, their next product lines.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very concerned about eroding their balance sheet in an uncertain economy and how the Wall Street will respond. So what we're really seeing is kind of a paralysis in a lot of the spending, even though, because the incentives don't seem to be strong enough to pry the money out of some of these reservoirs of capital that traditionally we go to.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a problem. And the only place I really see things going are luxury goods are selling like mad. You know, we're headquartered in Orange County, and every day going to work, I see more and more Ultra. I mean, Aston Martins and Turbo Bentleys walk by with the paper plate, temporary plates, new cars.
Right.
And so that type of acquisition is being spent because they're not, they don't, that doesn't show up on the balance sheet of the business.
Right. So California Capital Partners, you know, I'm sure that the returns that you're making for your investors have reduced over a few years, but is it still, you know, as tied to risk, still a good bet, well over money market, obviously, and those kind of things?
Yeah, so far, we're fortunate that we haven't had a single write-off of a portfolio company. Some of them are taking longer to get out of, but as I said, because we're a merchant bank, we're working the other side of the table.
Mm-hmm.
And we are taking some of these companies out to public markets for additional capital, as opposed to, but outside the U.S., say parenthetically, as opposed to the traditional model. And as for our own activities, I'd say most of our activity is less on the private side, private capital side now, and more on the investment banking activity. Because the need for capital is ubiquitous. The difficulty to getting it is ubiquitous. So that position of an agent to capital, there's a high demand for it right now.
Yeah.
And interesting enough, most of our capital is being sourced outside the U.S.
Say that again?
Most of the capital we're sourcing is coming from outside the U.S.
Oh, okay. So are you in, U.S. investors do have money, but they're just holding firm?
Yeah. I mean, I'm talking as a general trend. There are U.S. investors who are still spending and investing in deal. But, it's not the numbers that there used to be. And just taking a long time to get it. It's sometimes faster to go another way.
Right. And do you think that's an issue that investors need to deal with? In other words, should they be investing more, or are they doing the prudent thing?
Well, I think that the existing, when you speak investors, are you talking about people who invest in funds or people who are investing in companies?
I would have to say both, because you said most of your stuff is institutional now, but I guess I'm talking about the private investor.
Yeah, well, it's a good time for a private investor, I think, if they ally themselves with a group of like-minded people or a fund manager that they think meets their needs. Because it's a lot more research and, I won't say global reach, needs to be brought to the table today than ever before. Because there's just so much uncertainty in the local market, in the domestic market.
Right. But opportunity
so,
still about.
Yeah, you still need to, we use the term, you get more shots at goal. You know, it's a kind of a numbers game. So if you're planning the whole game around that one shot in the last second of the game, boy, that takes a cast iron stomach.
Okay, so what percentage of a, if I'm a private investor, what percentage would you recommend that I put into a venture capital type fund?
I would say I'd use that term alternate investment, and that would include venture capital, mezz debt, other types of vehicles like that. I would say at least 5%, depending on the size of your portfolio and the age, or your age and the age of your what your family, what have you, what you want, maybe as much as 15%.
Right.
We have one of our investors right now is doing a lot of private deals in real estate, both commercial and residential. But people don't have liquidity, need to keep their lifestyle going, and he's taking a lien on their place, and he's basically securitized almost 10-1, and getting a 15% interest rate. And you know, he said it wouldn't be the worst thing if someone defaulted.
Right. We're talking to John R. Nelson of CalCap Partners. That's California Capital Partners, about venture capital. John, I really appreciate you coming on today. I know you have a busy schedule, and you're just helping me out. You're not really pushing CalCap Partners as much as you are helping me educate people on what venture capital is, and I so appreciate your graciousness to come on and spend this kind of time with us.
It was a pleasure again, JW.
Anyway, this is JW Najarian and John Nelson from California Capital Partners. Everybody, have a great day and a better tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another in a series of podcasts brought to you by the Commercial Real Estate Professional Investors Group, also known as CRAPIG. CRAPIG can be found at www.crapig.com. CRAPIG Audio Series is a production of Meta Media Group, copyright 2011, and is the property of the Commercial Real Estate Professional Investors Group and Meta Media Group, and all rights are reserved.